Hello and welcome to 10 by 9, where 9 people have up to 10 minutes each to tell a true story from their own life. I'm Paul Doran, and this is the 10 by 9 podcast. Having moved on from our Nostalgia Fest celebrating our 300th podcast, here's some up-to-the-minute stories from our April event in Belfast's Black Box. It was St. George's Day, and what better way to celebrate the people, language and literature of the great nation of England than with true stories on the theme, English.
I mostly had to compile the meaning I could from sharp retorts if I got from questions I asked, like, what's wrong with England?
Told the boys to go off and play cricket, keeping us girls in the classroom. To enlighten us about the birds and the bees. Talk done. She unlocked the door, only to find all the boys still there.
For 15 years, they've been living night next door to each other, socializing in the same bar, and they'd never spoken to each other. He's not pure Irish at all.
So prepare for misunderstandings rooted hundreds of years ago, a common language that brought India and Ireland together, and we visit a brother in exile on an English golf course. Okay then, let's get started, and our opening story comes from a first-timer. Here's Kieran Gallagher.
At 7 years old, I was leaving every friend I'd ever known and the sunny, idyllic suburbs of York and leafy green England for a corner of Ireland I'd never been to, never heard of, and for some reason didn't use the silver Irish pounds with the deer on them. One that had edgy, suspicious children in school and stoic, intimidating armed soldiers on the walk at the end of the day. This was my new home, Belfast. I was the only Englishman in a new classroom filled with strange faces who didn't seem very agreeable to English blow-ins. Odd, I hadn't had this kind of difficulty with the friends I made in my grandparents' streets in Dublin. It took me some time to get any idea of what their objections to me or my country of birth were. I mostly had to compile the meaning I could from sharp retorts if I got from questions I asked, like, what's wrong with England? Because it's sadly true, they teach you nothing about Ireland in English schools. I knew nothing about the centuries-old tension between the country of my heritage and the one of my birth. At 10 years old, during an arts and crafts session in class, some of the pupils began making shapes and structures out of these coloured building blocks. While the teacher was briefly outside, one boy made a large Irish tricolour, and the other boys congratulated him on this construction. I thought it looked nice, and I thought I'd try compliment this by constructing an English St. George's cross. After I'd finished, I approached the other boys, smiling with excitement as I went, with the symbol of my own nation sitting proudly in my outstretched hands. After appealing for their attention slowly, one head after another turned, one smile after another dropped, conversations fell silent. What do you think you're doing? Someone said. It's an English flag, I said. Yeah, we know, they replied. An argument broke out, voices were raised, and one boy snatched my flag, held it high above his head, and brought it crashing down onto a table, smashing it into pieces. The boys cheered and laughed as I watched in silent dejection. I retreated away to the other side of the room and thought to myself, what had England done to them for us to deserve this spite? Before the end of primary school, I knew not to bring up England if it could be avoided. It was a quick and certain way to set myself up for a fight in which I would be alone. But maybe secondary school would be different. And it was a bit. The increase in maturity and social civility was an improvement, but inevitably curtailed by teenage angst and hormones. So at age 14, all of this was well demonstrated on a summer school trip to the Gaeltacht in Lochinure, Donegal. Whilst out walking, a disagreement arose between a schoolmate and I. He must have been dwelling on the history of Ireland and its sufferings at the hands of a mightier England, as he was in an angry mood and wanted answers from the latter's nearest representative, me. He subjected me to a stern line of questioning which could be summed up in two phrases. Are you with us or against us? And are you English or Irish? Now, by this age, I had lived in Ireland as long as I had lived in England. In fact, I had more years of memory from living here and memories of greater clarity that come with a developing mind. So my furious inquisitor was actually asking me a question I had already privately begun to ask myself, but I hadn't come up with an answer for him or myself. I replied, well, both, kind of, but still mostly English, I guess. Before long, we had a bout of fisticuffs and ended up wrestling on the grounds of somebody's garden. Thankfully, I was considerably bigger than him and he had no real physical damage to deal me. And I had no desire to harm him even after the aggression I'd received. 1 year later, at age 15, I had now been in Ireland for more of my life than I had in England. My second home was merely becoming home. I'd long had this boyish dream I had held on to of returning to England, back where all my friends were English just like me. No arguments over tense Anglo-Irish history. No explanations for my weird posh accent. Where life was simpler and happier. But I had grown up and knew this wasn't going to happen, not just because I knew my family was settled where it was, but because, having barely noticed it happening, I wasn't entirely English anymore. I had developed a sense of self that I could recognize as Irish, despite all the difficulties my Englishness had presented in that particular process. And I found there was plenty of room for both senses of self, especially seeing as I've come to recognize in recent years the two aren't nearly as different as many of us think. One day, probably that same year, my mother came into my bedroom and told me I would need to get a passport for our upcoming holiday. She said in a perfectly gentle tone, "Would I prefer to get an Irish one or a British one?" I thought about it for maybe a few seconds, and either my subconscious performed a lot of compiled emotional calculations in that moment, or it had become clearer than I had realised. "Irish," I said. In school, I was to learn about Irish history in history class. Maybe the subject reminded me too much of unpleasant conversations I'd had whilst growing up, but I didn't absorb it very well at the time. Maybe I thought I'd been made to feel bad enough about my country of birth, thank you very much. But that all changed immediately when I saw a film which finally made clear to me the mysterious disdain Ireland had for my dear England. At the school film club, run by Toon Friends, they showed the film Michael Collins. Even though there was a substitute there supervising who occasionally chimed in to declare a historical inaccuracy or creative license, it didn't matter. I was enthralled. I suddenly understood all these years what all the damn fuss was about. Those few crucial fateful years between the Easter Rising and the Anglo-Irish Treaty that portrayed a downtrodden group of rebels who stood defiantly against a cruel and uncompassionate English ruling establishment, all portrayed in digestible form. That is what my England had done? This is how cruel they were? Very quickly, the steadfast pillar of pride in my English origin crumbled. Not to nothing, but to a great deal less. The image of the Union Jack and the St. George's Cross were no longer portals to a merry childhood, but to a perfidious and callous legacy with which I couldn't abide. Gladly, I didn't hold on to these hasty emotional reactions for too long. Outraged teenage impressions of injustice eventually would give way to a deeper, more nuanced and adult interpretation of the complexities of our history. But nevertheless, that film was important. It gave me my first real taste of the grievance many Irish people carry. Finishing school, I went to Queen's University, an odd choice in a way, given all those years I had yearned to return to my merry old England. Here I was with offers for places in universities in England, and I had turned them all down to go to class just 2 miles away. But my English identity, now significantly watered down by time and environment, got one last time to express itself before it would become, for lack of a better phrase, retired. In Freshers' Week, I visited the halls of residence for Queen's every day, keen to make new friends. I was delighted to find that there were plenty of English students through whom I could reconnect in some way with my old country. It was delightful to experience again the subtle but significant differences in character between this side of the sea and that, which I had missed even more than I had realized. I even introduced myself a few times as part English. 3 years passed, and at age 22, just after university, I moved to New Zealand. It was there I discovered, through all my introductions and acquaintances I was making, that I was doing it exclusively as an Irishman. I never called myself English now. And when I met expats from all across the British Isles, I found firm camaraderie in all of their company, but I found the deepest in fellow Irish travellers, whether they were from the Republic or the North. Finally, at age 26, I did move back to England for a while, but I found myself to be something of a stranger to my old homeland. The connection with the people through little things like slang, colloquialisms, cultural references and humour just wasn't as strong or familiar as it was with the people from home. The Englishman was dead, and had died some years ago. Down the years, English incubation and Irish metamorphosis gave me endless food for thought about the nature of identity, history and heritage, particularly between such intimate and similar neighbours. Much thinking, rethinking, pondering, mental wandering, contemplation, meditation, historical inquiry and cultural anxiety, but I believe I was made richer for confronting those difficult questions than I would otherwise be for ignoring them for fear of ugly or unwelcome discoveries, especially in the Crucible of Ulster. But after this odd journey, I still feel something stir in me when I remember York, when I visit England and walk down those old streets and green paths by meadows that modernity hasn't yet transformed, when I read from England's wonderful canon of literature. But it's not the same England I left, and it never will be.
Thanks so much, Kieran. What a wonderful 10x9 debut. Great story, beautifully told. I hope you'll be back again soon with more. Here at 10x9, we're always looking for new storytellers. If you're wondering what the process is for telling your story, it's really simple. Check out the themes and dates on the website, then send your story through the submissions page. I'll give you feedback and help you make it the best it can be. If you're nervous, don't worry, you're never alone. It's a collaborative process. On to our second story, and it too comes from a first-timer. Anjali Kusakur had been part of the audience at the March 10x9 and was bitten by the bug. Here's her English story.
Most Indians are trilingual, that is, we speak three languages. I started off with my mother tongue, Marathi, and bits of the national language, Hindi. My two oldest sisters had already started schooling and were speaking English before me. Four-year-old me did not want to be left behind. My proud foray into the English language was a sentence that started with gibberish and ended with the word Dettol, much to the amusement of my parents and my sisters. Needless to say, I was never ever allowed to forget that. The medium of instruction in the schools that we attended was English, and very soon it became the main language in our household. Our schools still retained British standards and textbooks. We were learning nursery rhymes and poems from a land quite alien to ours. It was all about Jack Horner and Mary with a Little Lamb. There were no Radhas or Sitas or Rams. We'd compete in elocution competitions, reciting The Charge of the Light Brigade with all the required passion, or everyone's favorite poem, Wordsworth's Daffodils, never ever having seen a daffodil in our lives. It was a very anglicized education. But not everyone in India attended English medium schools. The vast majority studied in the regional language, which became very apparent to me when I joined medical college. Out of 200 students, just 12 of us were from English medium schools, and we stood out like sore thumbs. We were labeled as convent educated, which was a blanket term if you studied in an English medium school. I have to confess, though, that I did attend a convent, but only for the last 2 years of my schooling. And guess what? We had Irish nuns. It was the Presentation Convent in Jammu, where my dad, an army officer, had just been posted. Sister John, who was in charge of the senior school, greeted us that first morning that we arrived and escorted my sister and me to our respective classrooms. Cheerful and breezy, she always also struck me as being a no-nonsense kind of person. We were rather intrigued as to why all these Irish nuns had male names. Sister John, Sister Anthony, who was my favorite, Sister Pascal, and Sister Christopher. They dressed in demure habits and wimples so tight across their foreheads that we were convinced that they all had their heads shaven. That was until the day a lock of hair made a sudden appearance across Sister John's forehead. Ah, not bald after all. Amusingly, after that day, the lock seemed to appear rather frequently. Unsurprisingly, the nuns were Irish to the core. They had us all singing, "When Irish Eyes Are Smiling." Sister John's eyes would go misty as she played the piano and sang along in a soprano voice, or reminisced about her distant home, transporting us impressionable teenagers across the seas to Ireland. Some subjects were taught by the nuns. Sister John had a surprisingly good knowledge of local geography, which she taught us. She also took it upon herself to teach us other things, interesting ones. One day, she told the boys to go off and play cricket, keeping us girls in the classroom. She locked the door and gathered us together to enlighten us about the birds and the bees in hushed conspiratorial tones. Talk done, she unlocked the door only to find all the boys still there. Their ears glued to the door and their faces full of glee. Having lived in India for so long, the nuns were astute at getting jobs done. As this was an army station, they never hesitated getting favors from the army, who in turn did not mind at all. My dad would send the army pipe band for our annual school day, and we would do the Highland Fling to a merry Scottish tune. I guess there was no way they could have taught us Irish dancing. School days over, we all dispersed and lost touch with each other. Then some 25 years later, I was heading over to Belfast for a career opportunity to work as an anaesthetist. The few of my acquaintances who had ever heard of Belfast were horrified that I was going to the city of bombs. My very protective parents, however, were supportive, but they wanted to make sure I would have some contacts here to fall back upon. In their search, they discovered that Sister John was now retired and lived in Dublin. Who better as a local guardian for their dear daughter? Letters were sent off, and I came over in January of 94 with her contact details written down in my diary. I settled into my job and one day decided to call the Presentation Convent in Clondalkin. A jovial voice answered and asked me who I wanted to speak to. "Sister John, please," I said. "Ah, you mean Kathleen Glynn," she said. "I'll call her." Unbeknown to me, Sister John now had a feminine name. I heard her ring a bell. Three short rings, which I learned later was the code for Sister John. A few minutes later, I heard footsteps and the familiar, authoritative voice of Sister John saying, "Angelie!" As only she did. 25 years later, and the voice was still the same, with the crisp Dublin accent that I remembered so well. After a few excited exchanges, we decided to meet. She was now in her 80s, but very sprightly. She was now wearing regular women's clothes, and that took some getting used to. She came over and stayed with me a few times. On these occasions, I would be clearly instructed to take her to the right church for Sunday service. As we chatted, I got to know her better as an adult. I often felt sorry that the timing of birth and circumstance had trapped such a free-spirited person into a life of servitude. Not that she ever complained. She was actually nostalgic now about her days spent in the Indian subcontinent. Sister John was equally enthusiastic for me to visit her in Dublin, which I did on at least three memorable occasions. The first time was when my sister and my daughter were over from India. I have to admit that my sister was actually a favorite, but I always suspected that it was because they shared their birthdays. We took the train to Dublin and Sister John took charge. She had planned the entire day for us, sightseeing on a hop-on, hop-off bus. We took a taxi from Dublin Connolly to the bus stand. As the taxi left, I realized that I had left the bag in the boot. Panic. Not for Sister John, though. She assured us that the bag would be returned by the end of the day and that we should just carry on. In the bag, however, were some important items, my daughter's favorite toy, and samosas that my sister had made for Sister John. While the other three seemed to be enjoying the day, I was consumed with guilt and worry. Sister John was right, however. The bag had been returned to the taxi center before we left, and she did get her favorite samosas, after all. Then a few months later, she invited me to spend a weekend at the convent, an honor I could not refuse because I had never seen the inside of a convent before. I was given a beautifully furnished guest room. Sister John's hospitality was faultless. I had promised to cook her an Indian dinner one evening, so we went out shopping for ingredients, and soon I was in the kitchen in full flow. As the aroma spread around, curious nuns kept dropping in to investigate, but they were not getting an invitation. Sister John did not believe in sharing this exotic Indian meal with anybody. The year my dad came over to Belfast, Sister John wanted to show off the beauty of her beloved Ireland to him. We drove over from Belfast and she took us to Powers Court Gardens and Avoca. As we were driving along, I noticed a board saying Indian sculptures. I backed the car and drove in, only to find a field scattered with huge statues of Lord Ganesha. We were all baffled as well as enthralled to find a bit of India right in the middle of Ireland. Dad and Sister John conversed with discernible joy about their days spent in the Kashmir Valley and mutual acquaintances. Alas, though, as she entered her 90s, Sister John developed some health problems that limited her mobility. We did continue to stay in touch. On our last visit to her in a nursing home in 2004, we were saddened to see her looking frail and defeated. She was a person who had always been the one in charge, but now it seemed like she was handing over that charge. Sadly, we never saw her again. Thank you.
Oh, Anjali, what a gorgeous story full of love and affection. Thank you so much. Come back with more, please. And I'm sure there's a thesis to be written about the Irish teaching English to the Indians. But we'll leave that to the academics. Okay, just a quick thank you very much to all of you who donate or have donated to 10x9 via Patreon or at our live events over the years. It really helps keep this project going, and we are so grateful. If you're interested in donating, just go to Patreon or make a one-off donation via PayPal using our email address. Let's move on to our third and final story on this English-themed podcast. We've not heard from him in a while, so it was lovely to have Barney Gribben back at the 10x9 mic. Take it away, Barney.
My brother moved to England 40 years ago, and 25 years ago I went over to visit him, just to see how life was, and was he still an Irishman or had he turned into an Englishman? As soon as I walked into the house, I got my answer. He put the kettle on to make a cup of tea without even asking. Pure Irish. His local bar was in the village about 10 minutes walk away, and he goes there 3 or 4 times a month, so we headed off there that evening. I went up to the bar to get drinks, and there was a couple at the bar, and being Irish, I started chatting to them. I told them I was over from Northern Ireland visiting my brother. He lives about 10 minutes away, and they told me that this was their regular bar as well. They come there quite often. So I invited them down to the table to join us, and they spent the evening with us. And during the introduction, I found out that they lived in the house right next door to my brother Hugh. I couldn't believe it. For 15 years, they've been living right next door to each other, socializing in the same bar, and they'd never spoken to each other. He's not pure Irish at all. The next morning, Hugh was going out to get the papers. The neighbour was washing the car, and they bid each other good morning. And they stood and chatted over the fence for about 5 minutes. The first time in 15 years they had said good morning to each other. It took an Irishman to bring them together. I doubt he's half English now. The next day, Hugh had arranged for us to play in a pro-am golf tournament. It was a charity fundraising event. A pro-am tournament is, there's 4 players in the team. There's 1 professional and 3 amateurs. That's why it's called a pro-am. And there's a lot of the big name professionals at this event, and then a lot of other professionals just from local golf clubs. They're really good golfers, but they're not good enough to play the circuit. And it's just potluck who you get drawn with. We were drawn with Trevor. He was a professional from a local golf club. And the proposed name of our team was 2+2. 2 Englishmen, 2 Irishmen. And because of the incident in the bar the night before, I insisted we be called 2.5+1. We were actually very lucky to be drawn with Trevor because he was very pleasant. A lot of times at these events, the professionals are just there to support the charity and they don't even talk to the amateurs. But when we met Trevor on the first tee box, he said, boys, do you want to just play your own game or are you happy for me to give you tips? And we were delighted for him to give us tips. He would point where we should be driving our shots for, and he would do some club selections for us. And one of the holes, he told us to keep down the right-hand side. If you're down the left-hand side, your second shot is going to be over the water and it's quite difficult. I put my shot down the left-hand side. I put my second shot into the water. And Trevor says, Barney, I think you need your clubs cut. And I says, they're a bit long for me. I need to take a bit off. Oh, no, 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 no. He says, cut them in half. It makes it a lot easier to put them in the bin. Halfway around the course, we came to a long par four. There was trees down the left-hand side and trees down the right-hand side. And he says, look, there's no tips needed here, boys. Just keep your ball in play. Hugh hit his shot and it sliced away out, over the top of the trees, into another part of the golf course. We were heading down the fairway and Trevor called over to him. Hugh was heading through the forest. He says, Hugh, he says, if you get lost in there, just send a flare up. We'll send the rescue team in for you. A few minutes later, we heard this. I found it! Now, what he should be doing, playing the ball out to his left-hand side, in through a gap in the trees, onto his own fairway, and take his third shot to the green. A really good golfer would take his second shot over the trees and go for the green. Now, for an amateur to try and take that shot on, they'll pull it off once in every about 40 times. It's something you do when you're out playing with your friends, not when you're in a competition. The next thing we heard, keep an eye out for this. I thought, Jesus, he's going for the green. This ball is going to ping pong in through the trees here, what do you see? And the next thing, whack. And this ball comes soaring out over the trees and landed on the green. Unbelievable shot. Even Trevor was well impressed with it. In the clubhouse afterwards, that shot of Hughes earned us third place in the competition. And when the presentation was over, we retired to the bar for drinks, and the conversation was all about this shot that he pulled out over the trees. And Hughes says, boys, he says, I have a confession to make. It wasn't me that hit that shot. I says, what do you mean? He says, when I found my ball on the other fairway, the group that was playing that hole were coming past, and the professional that was with them was Seve Ballesteros. For anybody that knows nothing about golf, at that time, Seve Ballesteros was the equivalent of Rory McIlroy today. And if anybody doesn't know Rory McIlroy, there's nothing I can do to help you here now. But Seve Ballesteros came over to Hugh and he went, shh, shh. And it was him that hit that ball over the trees and onto the green. Now, by the rules of golf, we should have been penalised for that and we wouldn't have won third place in the competition. But I have that trophy in my home today in the living room. And when I look at it, I never think, I only have that because we cheated. I look at it and think, Seve Ballesteros won that trophy for me. About 6 months ago on a dark winter's morning, I was heading out to work. And I don't know how it happened, but when I was going out the door, a stray cat got in past me, and I didn't see her. I came home that evening, and the house was a mess. My heart missed a beat. I thought somebody had broken in. And then I heard, meow. Get out, you wee beautiful creature. Actually, the language is a lot rougher than that, but Paul wouldn't let me say it. I started tidying up around the house, and the shelf where I have all my trophies, the cat had been on it, and she had knocked every one of them off. Some of them had survived, but the Seve Ballesteros one was in bits. It's the only trophy that I won from cheating, and it was breaking my heart to put it in the bin. And I couldn't bring myself to throw it all in the bin, so I kept a bit of it. And this is what is left of the Seve Ballesteros trophy. Thank you very much.
Barney, thank you so much. The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice, as the great Martin Luther King told us, and you've proved him right. Great story. And I'll be sure to put up the photo of the remains of the trophy on our social media feeds. And that's it for this, our 302nd podcast. You can keep up with all our upcoming events and themes by having a look at the website, 10by9.com. And when you find a theme that fits, send me your story. 10by9 is on the socials, of course. Be sure to follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and or Instagram. We've roughly 3,000 followers now on each platform. And you can get in touch via email at 10by9belfast@gmail.com. Thanks to everyone who helped make 10by9 happen this week. The wonderful Margaret and Leanne, who are always so supportive. Thanks to the lovely team at the Black Box, the best venue in Belfast. Thanks to the 10by9 audience, of course. They really help support the storytellers and me. And of course, thanks to those storytellers. But a special thanks this week to Kieran Gallagher, Angelique Kusaker, and Barney Gribben. I'm Paul Doran, and I'll be back with another podcast soon. But for now, bye-bye.